In today's podcast episode, we follow up on the previous episode and we're taking a deeper dive into the world of neuromuscular diseases, Charcot-Marie tooth, neuropathies, and quite interestingly, the diagnosing process, what happens in the testing clinics and how are people diagnosed for a lot of these rare neurological conditions. We talk about a lot more of the things into the world of neurology, so I hope you enjoyed this podcast episode as you have listened to the last one. And again, I present to you Dr. Kita Ramhari.
Great to be back. So yes, I'm Kita Ramhari. I'm a consultant allied health professional in neuromuscular diseases. And I'm also an honorary associate professor who does research into supportive interventions and physical management of people with neuromuscular diseases as well.
Yeah, lovely. So I think we will start off with the initial one, which is, I know it's almost the, correct me if I'm wrong, it's almost a blanket term, you know, with diseases that involve muscle wasting particularly. There are quite a few number of them that some of them are more rare. Some of them are actually, I would say, more common than others in terms of the amount of people, you know, on a day-to-day, someone who is in your neuro will be seeing. Can you tell us some of these diseases that you personally have experienced as well?
Sure. So diseases where you see wasting of the muscles, collectively they're known as neuromuscular diseases. Well, that's certainly it. Certainly the Association of British Neurology, that's defined title or term here. Although you might see that there's a bit of a difference with that in other countries where the actually central nervous system diseases are brought in. But actually it's mainly diseases of the lower motor neuron. It could be from the anterior horn cell of the spinal cord through down to the muscle tissue and anything along. So that could include the peripheral nerve, the neuromuscular junction, or the muscle tissue. And an example of anterior horn cell diseases could be polio, for example, which is an infective disease, or motor neuron disease is an anterior horn cell condition. And then diseases of the peripheral nerves, that includes Guillain-Barré syndrome, or inherited peripheral neuropathy, such as Charcot-Marie tooth disease. That's an umbrella term for lots of genetic subtypes, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Diseases of the neuromuscular junction include myasthenia gravis. So that's normally when you have an issue with the neurotransmitter acetylcholine jumping across from the motor end plate to the muscle tissue or the muscle receptors. So there you get fatigability. And then there are conditions where the actual muscle membrane is involved. So the muscle membrane has a really complex proteins involved in the structure. So if there is a misspelling of some of those proteins through a genetic mutation, and then there's a disruption of the membrane, that's when we see muscular dystrophies. And then there are other types of muscle conditions that might be because of an inflammation, or where there's a problem with the mitochondria. So mitochondrial myopathies we see as well. So they can be hereditary as well if there's mutations of mitochondrial DNA. So they individually can be very rare, but collectively form quite a big group. Yeah. The most common condition disease that we will see that comes under the umbrella will be actually be diabetic neuropathy because of how common diabetes is. So we know to see people with diabetic neuropathy is quite common. But if we think about some of the hereditary conditions, then Charcot-Marie tooth disease is the most common inherited neurological disease. So you see 1 in 2,500 people may have Charcot-Marie tooth disease. And there's a big variability in the genetic cause. We know about 120 genes that cause CMT now, and also in the severity. So there are some people that may not really know they have it. They might just have high arches and maybe a little bit skinny in the, you know, a little bit of waste in the foot muscles, compared to some people who may not be able to walk. So there are some subtypes which are much more severe. And most people are sort of mild to moderate in the middle. So it is relatively common.
I was going to ask what are your standard clinical presentations you would see with people with for people listening with Charcot-Marie tooth disease?
So with Charcot-Marie tooth disease, it's because it's a peripheral neuropathy. We tend to see that there's usually a presentation of distal lower motor neuron weakness and wasting. So when you have lower motor neuron weakness, you tend to see really marked wasting of the muscles. Whereas if you have weakness, say in MS or after stroke, you don't get that really severe wasting. You might get some disuse atrophy, but not the really severe wasting that we see in neuromuscular diseases. So with somebody with CMT, it tends to affect the peripheries first, so particularly the feet. So they call it a length-dependent neuropathy. So it starts in the toes and the intrinsic muscles of the feet. It can ascend up into the anterior tibials and maybe the calf. Sometimes it can go above the knee. That's not as common, but it can happen with some people. And then also, if we think about long nerves, obviously the longest nerve is in the leg, but also the arm nerves are quite long. So some people, the hand muscles, usually the intrinsic hand muscles, get affected as well. So, and then because in most types, there's also a sensory element as well. So people will have that sort of like glove and stocking sensory impairment, sometimes a pinprick or vibration sense, depending on the type of CMT that they have. So it's the for a while it was called hereditary motor sensory neuropathy. But there are some subtypes which are mainly sensory, and there are some subtypes which are mainly motor. So CMT was, Charcot-Marie tooth disease was used as an umbrella term to bring them all in, and that was the names Charcot-Marie and tooth were the neurologists who first described it in the 1880s. So that was just decided by the international consortium just to bring them all together, so that every subtype was sort of came in for inherited neuropathies.
Okay. And the things you said now, I think even the presentation, particularly when you said, I think I've seen people with CMTD, is that the CMT? And particularly I've seen the differences, as you said, in when you have someone with stroke or MS, that type of, you know, people, someone who's bed bound and has muscle wasting is different from what you will see with CMTD in terms of their presentation at all.
Yeah.
You also mentioned diabetic neuropathies as that one is one that you said is very prevalent in the population, just because of how prevalent diabetes is. And I've seen a few different presentations, and tell me if there's any more that I'm missing or what's actually happening with this. So something like, as you said, lost sensation, lost sensation in their feet, which then leads to things like coordination issues, because if you don't have deep sensation in your feet, you're going to tend to struggle being able to sense where you are. You have some spatial awareness issues in terms of when you place your feet, when is your left leg down, when is your right leg down, are you touching the floor? And I've heard this expression, analogy. Yeah, this is based off my own personal experience, where they say things like, you know, it feels like either glass, they're walking on glass, or some people say it feels very hot and they can't feel anything. So it's just an almost distorted sensation, which obviously leads to balance issues and so.
So I think when you're making sense of the sensory symptoms in any type of neuropathy, it's about going back to what pathology is. So in diabetic neuropathy, it tends to be where the axons of the nerve, so remember with the nerves, we've got the axon and then we've got the myelin sheath. And the myelin sheath is present not in all fiber types, because in things like our C fibers and our delta fibers, they're not thickly myelinated, but some of our peripheral nerve fibers are. So if we think about the motor neurons are very thickly myelinated, because you want to transmit very fast signals to the muscles. So alpha motor neurons are very thickly myelinated. The other group that are very thickly myelinated are the 1A afferent. So they're the sensory neurons that come from the muscle spindle within the muscles, because you need to pick up very quickly any length changes in the muscle, because that gives you some of your proprioception. That gives you a sense of where you are in space, and very important for things like standing and quick stretch when you're walking. It can help to initiate stepping and that sort of thing. So with diabetic neuropathy, that tends to be an axonal neuropathy. So you tend to find that the nerve fiber types that are mainly affected are the small fibers. So those are your pain fibers, your temperature fibers, the ones that are not thickly myelinated so much. You can get some problems with the thickly myelinated, but it's a bit more global, if you see what I mean. So that's why you often hear these, what we call neuropathic symptoms. So that is the burning feet, the, like you were saying, the sort of feeling like they're on something like glass, you know, but certainly that perception of burning is really, really common. But you can also, certainly work that's been done looking at balance shows that there might be some evidence of proprioceptive loss. Because when we think of proprioception, it's mainly the sort of large fibre. So our neurology colleagues do, in a standard neurological assessment, we use a tuning fork, and that's for vibration sense. And that will give you an indication of what level you might be having problems with the sort of 1A afferent, that's the fast proprioceptive feedback. So that can be really helpful. And with something like CMT, for example, different genetic types will give you either an axonal presentation. Mm-hmm. So there are people who can also have a lot of neuropathic pain or burning or, you know, nighttime random pains, which is peripheral neuropathic. But the people where the problem is mainly with the myelin, so the most common type of CMT, for example, is called CMT1A, and that's a demyelinating neuropathy. So it's the myelin that tends to be affected, so it slows down the nerve conduction. They tend to have fewer problems with the neuropathic pain. They can do, but it's less prevalent. But it's more about you can see when you get somebody in the balance lab that actually proprioception, you can measure that proprioception is more impaired when you do a neurological examination. But the consequence of that is that you see more issues to do with sway, particularly with eyes closed, on soft surfaces, that understanding, knowing where the feet are in space, particularly if the higher up that people are affected. So actually understanding the neurophysiology of the peripheral nerves is really actually very helpful for making sense of what you're seeing.
I think it is. Definitely, you know, in university, we are taught a good level of the pathophysiology, but not as in depth as, you know, you can get taught the theory of something, you know, you can get taught the theory of X, Y, Z. You can get taught theory of how, you know, nerve conductivity, X, Y, and Z. When you see it in person and you see the more traditional pathologies, you can still make sense of it. You know, when I opted out of university straight, saw a dementia patient, saw Parkinson's patients, I could immediately recognize some of the symptoms. When you start looking at some of these things like proliferative neuropathies or diabetic neuropathy, you start wondering, this seems very interesting. And it's until you dive a bit further, until you start to investigate. But the one thing that you mentioned things about tuning fork now, which I have to ask. I know this is be relevant to most people. For example, take, I'm a neurological physiotherapist working in the community or just a community therapist. I've seen certain patients that I think, you know, something doesn't seem right here. And something seems very neurological, and I can use that based off, you know, just my clinical judgment and clinical presentation or how they're looking, maybe severe coordination issues. I've done some neurological testing, the basic one I can do community, maybe severe loss of sensation, or their walking is very, maybe some foot drop or very, very ataxic walking. And you look at their medical history and you don't see any particularly neurological issue, no Parkinson's, no neuropathy, no anything. So the next thing I tend to do most times, you ask the GP, because we can't refer directly for neurological special testing. What actually, and then the GP does that. What happens? Do you know what happens, or how is it? How are these, some of these tests, like the ones we're talking about, the neuropathy, no, the diabetic neuropathy, the Charcot-Marie tooth, how are they diagnosed, and what happens in that lab where the neuro specialist actually starts to test the diagnosis? What, can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I sit in some multidisciplinary clinics, so I sort of see it happening in front of me, which is great. So so if somebody comes in with a suspected neuropathy, might come to the clinic of one of our professors here. And so the first thing she would take is a really in-depth history to see if some of the things, if they're starting to describe things like pain, loss of sensation, if there's issues with balance, you know, when they might be manifesting. But also, really importantly for the people that we see, any family history. Is there anybody else? So. You know, actually, and also trying to pinpoint, is this something that's come on very quickly over the last month? Or is this something that's been going back for years? Because if something has perhaps come in childhood, you know, I had high arches as a child, or I used to trip a lot, and it got a little bit worse when I was a teenager, and then it sort of, you know, settled out, but I'm still getting slightly worse. That's often an indicator of a genetic condition. So something that is sort of long history, slowly progressive, something that's come over in, say, 3 weeks or you know, in a couple, 3 months, whatever, something that's bang, it's come on, might be indicative of sort of an inflammatory process, or perhaps, you know, some sort of toxic neuropathy, or, you know, chemotherapy induced. You want to know if they've been on any other treatment, chemotherapy induced neuropathies, if they drink, because they're alcoholic neuropathies, etc. So the history is really, really, really key. And that's one of the professors I work with, and she's really adamant about this, is that how you get so many clues from the history. Then the neurologic examination. So you'd be observing somebody getting out of chair, observing somebody walking, somebody standing. Can they stand and close their eyes? What happens then? Can they walk on their tiptoes? Can they walk on their heels? Looking at vision, hearing, but also then doing manual muscle testing. And then the sensory testing, which might be looking at pinprick and vibration sense and joint position sense as well. And then that helps you to pick up a picture. And a lot of it's pattern recognition. If they are suspicious that there might be a neuropathy or a muscle condition, they will refer to our neurophysiologists. So in one of the clinics I go in, there's a neurophysiologist who sits in, which is great because they can then go from one room to the next. So, and what he will look at is the conduction of the nerves. So he'll be looking to see. So if I pass a current at one end of a nerve and pick up the signal at the other end, is that slowed down, or is it the same speed but the actual amplitude is less? That might give some. Is it same on both sides? Is it symmetrical, or actually is it a bit patchy in different nerves? Is it more on one side than the other? And then they will sometimes put a needle into the muscles, do EMG, and some the patterns of firing can tell you things, whether or not he thinks it's a neuropathic problem or is it a myopathic problem with the muscle. So there's so many clues can come from the neurophysiology. There's often a big discussion, and then on the basis of that, then there'll be more tests. So whether or not you'll be screening for something like a muscle enzyme, or you'll be doing some genetic testing, or, you know, so it's a big sort of pulling together of the patterns. But again, you know, there's a professor I work with, the one who sort of says about the clinical history is really important. She also says that the physical examination is really key as well, because that this is where you're observing, and you're observing movement, you're observing any muscle wasting, yeah, any joint deformity, etc. So you might get confirmative tests from genetic testing or muscle biopsy or that sort of thing, but you've already started to channel what they're thinking based on the history and the clinical exam.
Yeah, okay, that is very, very interesting, because again, as I've said, I send people off to do neurological tests sometimes when I'm suspecting something, or something seems very, very not normal per se to them particularly. I ask some of these questions as well, but not, I'm definitely sure, not as in depth as what will be done when they get to that clinic. I'm asking these questions so that when I make a referral, or I, you know, for my own clinical reasoning as to why I have sent this patient on for further investigations. And it's actually quite interesting to know what's actually happening on that other side, because then they, you know, sometimes patients will come back to myself, or they've come back into our service and they've said, oh, they've had just nerve conductivity testing, or they've had X, Y, and Z. And I'll ask them, how were you diagnosed? And they say, this is how they were diagnosed. I think it's very, very interesting. Would you say, is it a long process, would you say, before you can come to a conclusive diagnosis on a specific disease?
I think it depends. I think it depends on the rarity of the condition, really. So we have some people where, you know, they can be diagnosed quite quickly, and then it might be confirmed with a genetic test, for example, if it's an inherited condition. But there are some people who we suspect, for example, that they've got a genetic neuropathy or a myopathy, but we don't, there aren't, you do all the genetic tests that are available, but they don't cover them all, because we're discovering new ones all the time. So they might be undiagnosed for some years, but it will still sort of come under that umbrella of, you know, so for some of the people I see, it might be Charcot-Marie tooth and then in brackets genetically unclassified. But the neurophysiological patterns and the history and the disease profile is indicating that it is an inherited condition or an inflammatory. So if you think about something like Guillain-Barré syndrome, that has a very distinct pattern to when it comes on. Timing is very important. So you have your 4 weeks before to the nadir, which is when people are at their worst level, and then you get this trajectory of improvement, for example. So if you start to see sort of ascending sensory loss and ascending weakness, and somebody maybe has had food poisoning beforehand and that sort of thing. So then it's like you say, you know, for you, it's knowing what those signs are that, oh, hang on a minute, I think I might need to get, there are some definite neurological symptoms here that what this person's complaining of. I'm quite suspicious of this. And that's when you'd be wanting them to be reviewed by a neurologist. And the good thing then is when, particularly a service like ours, when somebody is diagnosed, even if it's not precisely diagnosed, but we have an indication of what condition group it is, they then get access to the rest of the team. We've got fantastic clinical nurse specialists here who provide excellent support for them. And then us as the physiotherapy team, our occupational therapists, our orthotists. So then we can then implement interventions that can help that person get on day to day.
Okay, with timely input, I think that's something your team would benefit from, is when you get that diagnosis, they have the people within the area, very close proximity, to begin that support network, which brings me to the next thing. I think you'll appreciate, or people listening, you know, when you're talking about, you know, diagnosing of a neurological disease or condition, talking about getting that treatment, we also talk about what happens when someone goes undiagnosed for a long time.
This
one itself is a very problematic one. You know, from a basic standpoint, we know that, you know, in any disease or any pathology, let's say, before I come back to MSK, which I want a urine impedance, take an ankle sprain, for example, if you want to break it down, or shoulder injury. You fracture your shoulder and the shoulder heals and you have no input afterwards. And then you come 2 years later and you say you had a fractured shoulder. That very unlikely you'll get your full range back in that shoulder because of how late you left it. Stroke, for example, is one we commonly know that, you know, the optimal window for rehab after a stroke is within the first year of stroke. That's when you want to start that aggressive physiotherapy per se, you know, aggressive mind method, but you want that more input on, you know, having a physio within the first year is very different from having physio 3 years after a stroke and never having a physio in the beginning.
Yes.
For these type of conditions particularly, how important is it to get a diagnosis early, and what are the consequences, particularly if you go undiagnosed for periods of time? Because there are people within the community now who have neurological issues and neurological conditions that are undiagnosed. It's very unfortunate, but it just happens.
I think there's two elements to that. There's yes, and I mean, I have some people who have been, they've been going from pillar to post for years and years and years, and they might not have had the diagnosis for 10, 15 years. And that could be because they got something very rare, or they just weren't presented to the right people, or they were just sort of left to their own devices. And the diagnosis can be very important to the person living with the condition, because I think then it allows them to understand a bit more, make sense of what's happening to their body. But I think sometimes for us as physios, you know, I think we also can treat what we see as well. So if somebody hasn't been they don't have a definitive diagnosis, but they've got obvious foot drop, for example, or they're getting really deconditioned, then you would still, be implementing things to try and support that. But the consequences, the people who I've seen who maybe haven't, you know, some people have never seen a physio, or I saw a lady in my clinic on Friday who had a lot of quite bad musculoskeletal complications from having CMT. So she said this, I've never seen patellofemoral joints like it. Basically her patellae were just sitting on the lateral condyle, you know, laterally, they're sort of permanently subluxed despite surgery. And so she had a combination of Charcot-Marie tooth disease and hypermobility. So, you know, repeated dislocations, everything. But she hadn't seen a physio for years. And part of me does wonder, well, could we have had a more positive impact on that level of musculoskeletal deformity that she now has, you know, through range of motion, stretching, strengthening, you know, some of the work that we might do in, for people with patellofemoral issues. Certainly, I think when it comes to the types of CMT that come on in childhood, getting good orthotics, insoles, stretching regimes early mm-hmm. can help to stop fixed foot deformities. Because once the foot deformity becomes fixed, then the next step is surgery. So getting people set up with good orthotics is actually really, really important. And, you know, we might be able to prevent falls because, as we know, if somebody falls, their confidence can go, they can be avoiding activity because of it, become secondary deconditioning because of that activity avoidance, stop going out. What's all the impact of that on that person's quality of life and that person's psychological well-being as well as their physical well-being? So if we can get in and give them orthotics so they're not tripping all the time, you know, maybe walking aids, etc., that those things might seem very simple and not, you know, sexy techniques when it comes to physio. Do you know what I mean? There's not some guru attaching their name to something novel. This is sort of core business, but something that actually is, I have to say, in all the years I've been working, I'm a specialist in this condition. I've been a physio for probably like 28 years now. But sometimes the biggest effect I can have on somebody, and it's lovely when it happens, is that I might give somebody a sports brace. There's particular sports braces we use that reduce foot drop. They're very comfortable.
Yeah.
That person wears them. All of a sudden, they are not tripping so much. They're comfortable. They wear them outside, and they are delighted. Yeah. And all I've done is given them a pair of ankle supports. But the right ones, of course. That's where the clinical reasoning comes in. But still, you know, what can be relatively simple can just make such a big difference for somebody. And I think we should never forget that. We don't have to be fancy all the time. Some of our core business is very valuable to people.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. You know, they are very, you know, in the world of, you know, as we are, as sciences and technologies is continuously evolving, you know, treatments are coming up. I think sometimes people get carried away trying to use the most complex treatment or the newest thing to treat. But there are the very core basics that I think everyone needs to know. And as you said, you know, those little things where you just give this as something that is simple to, you know, in the world of therapies or any modalities, and you find it's had such a huge impact on someone's quality of life. That is what, you know, brings us joy particularly. I think you mentioned that, you know, there are those things that if we are implementing at an early stage can have a good impact. Some, yes, you know, there are cases where whatever if we had seen them on day one or day 10 or day 20 or 20, 10 years later, the impact we may have may be limited. But we need to, you know, it's trying to make sure that we're not missing those which we will actually may have high impact of at the moment. I'm sure you, as you said, you've seen people who've not seen physio in multiple years, and they've come and then seen you, you know, with these progressive diseases, particularly in like CMT, as you said, and Guillain-Barré syndrome that people live with. How do you think, you know, you see this quite more than me, definitely, since I moved away from neuro. The lived experiences of patients, what are you seeing on ground in terms of, you know, I'm sure you've seen, you know, you've been qualified for quite a long time. So you've seen progression of it in terms of someone who has just been diagnosed today versus someone who has been diagnosed for 10, 15 years. I know there are some also neurological conditions that have a limit that unfortunately will limit someone's potential lifespan, which is unfortunate. You know, I've kind of asked you about three different questions now already, but let's take whichever as you choose to answer first. You know, that one also interests me quite a lot. Those diseases that limit lifespan particularly. And obviously what's happening with patients and how are they feeling about that?
Yeah, I think it is very individual to the person, but you definitely see people go through those stages. You know, there are people who certainly are very accepting of their diagnosis and we'll implement things and you know we'll try and keep active and try and do things to benefit them. There are some people who really struggle with that Which I think we see this in other areas, you know.
In the area of life, yeah.
Very much so, you know. But I think what's really interesting with that, even with this, I'll come to the fast progressing conditions in a minute, but the slower progressing conditions, there's somebody I know quite well who did his psychology doctorate in this, and he also lives with a muscle wasting condition, and he interviewed people with CMT. And he identified that although the condition sort of can change very slowly over time, people will suddenly notice that, oh, that's got more difficult. So these sort of thresholds of disability reach. And he described that people were sort of talking about like a sense of loss and a sense of grief every time that realization happened. So, you know, I mentioned the chap, I think, in my last podcast about, you know, there's now something chasing me, sort of, yeah, you know, and if yeah. I stop with my management strategies, it will overwhelm. So I think some people can feel like that. Other people are just very pragmatic and can get on with it. Some people really don't manage well at all. And particularly, I have to say, I find the people who also have a lot of pain really can struggle enormously. When it comes to the faster, you know, the conditions where it will shorten people's life, then the palliative care side of things come in very much so. And it's not an area I work in so much, but I have colleagues who work in the MND service here. So it's about support with breathing, peg feeding, for example, with the MND patients, but also talking about what they want when they are ready to be accepting some of these things and where they want them to happen and support for the family. So it's very much a more holistic palliative care model. So it is a little bit variable, but I think us being open to the fact that everybody will respond in different ways. And I think this is where some of the self-management support interventions, which I know I mentioned at the end of the last podcast, can be very helpful for people making sense of what they understand about the condition and how they will be affected over time, and what they can do to be able to help. And it's very variable. Some people will engage with that and be really making positive changes. Other people really struggle. As with other specialities, yeah, I'm sure.
Exactly. And, you know, I've seen this firsthand, particularly with these progressive diseases. And I've seen, you know, I think everyone has, no matter how long you've qualified, not even half the one you have qualified for. What you have patients where, or you see people in life in general where they really made an impact on. And that, yeah, it's almost a pivotal moment. I remember clearly, you know, there's someone I saw a while ago now, and that new diagnosis of MS, and she was such an active person before, you know, gym goer, exercised 4 times a week, walked the dog, had a family. And this was a new diagnosis. And as you said, these things that we take, you know, as daily activity, the ability to walk outside by yourself, go down to the shop and come back, you know, you just find suddenly that one day, oh, I can't do that. It's really hard to do that. Or it's really hard to brush my teeth. Or, you know, it's really hard to get out of bed. And, you know, it's very, you know, in the other modalities, it's very, you know, it's similar. But some of these are also with geriatrics, you know, as you'd expect. But these neurological conditions, I think the age at which it affects people is the part that almost hits home, you know, when you see someone in their 30s. Really struggling with this, you know, and they still have so much life in them left to live with. Someone in their 40s, their 50s, you know, I've seen some of that in fairly young as well. But I was going to ask that my next question actually is the ages. I know you said some of these are from birth, to be honest, or from a very young age, and they just have to manage through it through life, particularly. It's very, very.
Yeah, I think what's interesting though is that some of the people who have these conditions from childhood, for example, and particularly the hereditary conditions, because they won't be the only person in the family.
Yeah.
So it might be they've got a sibling with the condition, and certainly one of their parents often, not every time, because sometimes there can be recessive conditions, but we see people with dominant conditions. So actually, I think sometimes that's all somebody's known. Sometimes what I actually see is the people who struggle more, maybe the people who got it later in life. So, you know, a condition that I see called inclusion body myositis tends to come on later in life. And the person might have been extremely active. You know, I've got a couple of people who were sportsmen in their youth, and then now in the sort of 60s and 70s, they can't get out of a chair. And actually, that can be really impactful for somebody. It doesn't always necessarily mean that a condition that comes on early in life means that that person has worse quality of life. In fact, often there's what we call the quality of life paradox, or the disability paradox, that sometimes the people who are most severely affected are actually report higher quality of life than others who it might be the other way around. So it doesn't correlate. And I know when I was doing my PhD work years and years ago, and we were looking at people who were walking on a treadmill, people with Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, and we were trying to get them to walk to a level of fatigue. We were looking at walking endurance. Where people in a hoist sling, so they, you know, trip on the treadmill. We kept them walking till they reached level 17 on the Borg scale, you know, the Borg perceived effort scale. And there was one person who probably had the weakest muscles, and he walked for nearly 2 hours. I mean, we were exhausted. You know, he was a march player, really, you know, marching with vigor. He probably had, if you were to do muscle testing, he would have had the weakest muscles, but he walked for probably he was probably the second longest. And then we had somebody who actually was very mild when you did the muscle testing, etc. So the neuropathy was less severe, but they only walked for 10 minutes. And actually what seemed to correlate more there was actually their reported fatigue. So that sort of chronic fatigue report seemed to have, so he reported very low levels of fatigue, and she reported very high levels of fatigue. So there are other things at play, I think, sometimes when it comes to, I mean, fatigue isn't necessarily an indicator of quality of life, but I think that just shows where there is a paradox in how somebody physically presents and then how somebody functions.
Yeah, I think that's I like that, how they physically present versus how they actually function in their day-to-day activities. And it's very similar with, you know, when we do muscle testing or our core objective markers, and you, based off that, you expect or you naturally assume
that's
something,
but
it actually doesn't correlate, and it's not marrying up with what you're thinking, and then you get flustered. And it's a strange phenomenon to a lot of people, but it's more common than you would naturally think. It's very interesting pathologies that we've covered today, I think. Overall, these conditions, you know, as you said, people will present very differently, and those on the, but it's not, you know, there's not a death sentence per se for any of these, because there are modalities, treatments, interventions that we can do to really impact the quality of life. Where do you think, and I think we'll soon be wrapping, but I want to get your thoughts on, where do you see the treatments, or are they getting more effective in terms of beyond just even if you count physiotherapy treatments or other treatments you've seen, be it, you know, gene therapy, as you mentioned before in the past, or medication, are they improving at a rate where you would say it's looking very promising for some of these diseases that are, you know, progressive, to have no specific cure? Or would you say it's slow, or is it more plateauing, or is this difficult to develop?
I think it depends on what the pathology is. So, for example, for the inflammatory conditions, whether it's Guillain-Barré or chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyradiculin neuropathy, which is a bit of a mouthful, but that's another condition we see a lot of here. So actually some of the autoimmune, the immunotherapies are very good. So intravenous immunoglobulin, steroids, medications that work on the immune system can be very effective. With the hereditary conditions, up until the last few years, there's been no treatment. But as I mentioned in the last podcast, we're entering a new era. So we are now seeing that there are some, with some of the technologies, the CRISPR technologies, and we can now influence the expression of some genes. So in neuromuscular diseases, there's a condition called spinal muscular atrophy, which has different types. So there's a type 1, 2, 3, and 4. And type 1, which is the most severe type, meant that babies would die after, you know, within the first year. And so they now have a treatment They have to put it in through the spine, so it's not sort of a straightforward thing. It's hugely expensive, but it now means that some of these children are now living, you know, they're 6-7 years old now, so they still have some physical disability, but they're alive and they're sitting up and there's some quality of life. And there's now an oral version of that, and it's now, we're now starting to treat adults with it. In fact, on Saturday I'll be doing some outcome measurement for that, because with some of these drug pathways we have to measure the impact of that. So our physio medical nursing team here, we're all guns blazing at the moment, sort of just trying to track how these people are doing who are starting these treatments. So that's very exciting. And there's a type of a rare type of inherited neuropathy that has a gene therapy. There's one that's just been tested in a type of muscular dystrophy called FSHD. So we're waiting to see how that rolls out. Well, there might be another efficacy trial, but so that's been positive. So, and a lot of these are the slow or maybe halt progression, and that's what we're hoping. With the one called transthyretin. I can't remember the full name of it, but it's TTR. Amyloid related neuropathy. So that was a condition that was fatal within perhaps 4 or 5 years. Okay. And whereas now people's condition is now stabilizing, and people are doing really well with it. And they're people we see in our clinic. There's a lot of work going on with our basic science colleagues, looking at different ways of impacting the expression of certain genes. So I think it's going to be a really exciting time. What I say to some of my patients now is, you know, these treatments are on the horizon now, and the moment the best outcome will be that they will halt progression or slow it. What they can't do at the moment is reverse it. But if there's a possibility of halting progression, A, we want to have them, you know, really tip top, optimally, you know, as strong as they can be, as fit as they can be, so then they can really get benefit from these treatments. But also, I think, and a couple of the muscular dystrophy patients have said this to me, you know, that all they could see in their future was decline. Yeah. And if that is taken away, and actually, okay, I've still got disability, but this is where I am. Kind of plan ahead a bit more now, you know, the future is a little bit more certain, even though I still have, you know, this weakness in this limb or whatever. There is hope for that. I mean, there is work being done on how we regenerate muscle, regenerate nerve, but that's probably further down the line. I think it is another era is dawning, and actually where we fit with that, I think, is very much around getting people, you know, prehab almost, so that they're as well as possible to then really maximize the benefits. But I think when we're starting to look at interventions and therapeutic interventions designed to build muscle, for example, then actually I think I said this in the last podcast, but I think that obviously we will have a really key role there of, you can build muscle, but that muscle then has to be used in a coordinated fashion within a function, and there needs to, that muscle needs to have not only strength but endurance, or, you know, it's not just cross-sectional area of muscle bulk regenerated. We've got to be able to actually make it functional. So I think that's where I think those protocols will be very interesting as they start to develop, and with those interventions.
No, I think you're giving a good outlook on the future of things. And as you said, I think with everything, it's time. When a new treatment, a new intervention is created, even as you said, people who are the babies who got that treatment, you know, you have to see how, you know, if they got it 7 years ago, they're only 7 years old now. We don't know what they would be like, you know, what their prognosis is 20 years or when they're 50 years old. And the only way you'll know that is, unfortunately, we cannot fast forward time in isolation in one person. You have to just wait it out and keep continuing observations. And that's something I think I've always found very interesting. And I think, you know, researchers can be very dedicated in following a patient or some phenomenon for 20, 30 years.
Oh, Well, we're doing that now because it's like there's a new natural history. So one of the more common muscular dystrophies that starts in childhood is Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And a lot of people would have heard of that. That's the one that affects young boys. And young boys would have, you know, passed away at 13, 14 years old, early teenage years. Some years ago, they started giving them steroids. And so what we now have, and there's a PhD student I'm a second supervisor for, and she's looking at this. We now have men living with this condition, men going into their 20s, 30s, you know, some even older. There's a young man I see in my clinic who is 19 years old and he can still walk. Not normally, but he can walk. Now, that would have been unheard of 20 years ago. So there's this new natural history now because of these interventions. So steroids have their, you know, long-term steroid use has its risks. But what she is looking at is that what are the differences in the steroid, the boys and young men who've had steroids by the time they get to adulthood compared to those who are steroid naive, when we're looking at respiratory function, we're looking at, their physical functioning, things like bladder, bowel, you know, it's renal, it guts, it can be very multi-system. Yeah. But it's very interesting what they're finding actually, and you know, what has been beneficial. So hopefully her work might actually really help to change practice. And also boys and young men who've been on steroids and then it's stopped. Okay. What's the difference there? So this is a new natural history that certainly, as I say, 20 years ago
was not the case.
The outlook was much, much bleaker, and we see that in other genetic conditions as well, like cystic fibrosis, and there's a respiratory condition, but that has gene therapies, and that how that is now impacting that people living much, much longer than they would have done. They'd have died in teenage years. You know, there's a guy I see who's got muscular dystrophy and CF. So, and the gene editing has been transformative for him for the respiratory condition.
It's very interesting. And I mean, as soon as you mentioned cystic fibrosis, my brain lit up because I remember I had it. That's one of my most favorite, my favorite placements I had. And, you know, I could see people at different ages with cystic fibrosis, quite older in the cystic fibrosis. And some were managing quite well, you know, having different modalities and treatments. And it was still just management. They would only come in just as a checkup to see how things are going, almost as an outpatient setting, because they were managing their disease, the condition quite well, actually, based on multiple things. And steroid use, as you said, was quite interesting in involvement in them. I think we've definitely touched on quite very interesting topics. I know I myself particularly, you know, the end of these two podcasts and topics that we've done, I've learned quite a few things in terms of just even the anatomy and the science that is happening behind it from a neurological standpoint. And I think We do, you know, as therapists or medical professionals, when you go out and treat and when you do, you know, things particularly, and you don't have the full, complete understanding why, all you know is, you know, in university, they told me to do this when you see this, and therefore I was doing this and this, and that is my clinical reasoning. When you have a bit of an in-depth analysis of what's happening in both the brain as per se and the mind of an individual, both also knowing what's actually out there in terms of resources, what can be done, what's actually ongoing. Because, you know, I'll be honest, you know, research to most people, and I'm sure not to people like yourself, you know, myself as well, research, when you mentioned research, it immediately shut down. I'll be honest, I used to be like that. I did not love to read long papers as a university student. I've started reading them now because they're quite interesting. But back then, they were very lengthy, and going through them was not as interesting as you see when you start seeing the actual impact of why it's important that we keep up to date with practice, or why, you know, when you read this and it has an impact, or actually knowing what's ongoing around the topic that you're treating or the patients that you're treating, it really has that impact when you're either explaining a condition to a patient, or you really can explain it in very good detail where they can feel like, you know, they've come away and, okay, they have a bit of understanding. Because, you know, as you know this, you might explain a condition to a patient very differently from the way I might explain it to someone. Someone might give too little information where they still left confused, or you might use the most confusing lingo and confusing terminologies where they're still confused. You've explained it very well, but you've not made it very appropriate. And it's that delivery of information. I know you were about to say something that caught you off there. I'll let you have one of the last words, because I think this podcast is very interesting for myself as well.
Yeah, it's a good point. You say, you know, how do we keep up to date with all the research? I think that's really tough, actually, tough. Because there's so much being done, you know, and we've got to treat patients, so we can't be trawling, you know, PubMed or whatever all the time. But I think there are, there's people who will do that for us in systematic reviews and educational reviews and narrative reviews. So that's why the tip I gave in the last podcast, you know, and this is just because I do it, you know, if I need to get to know a topic area really quickly, I will go onto PubMed or Google Scholar and put in my keywords, but also then put review just to see if somebody's already done the work for me, which is quite just a little sort of, you know, that's maybe a lazy physio way of doing it, but also I do think it's important that we are keeping our skills up in critical appraisal as well, though, because I review papers a lot for journals, and also because I write journal articles, I know, you know, the blood, sweat and tears that goes behind it, and you always want to put a bit of a positive spin on it, and you might, there's a lot of overstatement of results and that sort of thing. So actually still having that critical eye is important as well before we go in and wholeheartedly change what we're doing. You know, we do have to think about, if we really are going to change practice in a serious way, we really have to have the weight of evidence behind that. And we have to be a bit careful of not just, there was a big debate we had in neuro a while ago. You know, do we have to be careful of evidence-tinged practice rather than, so are we changing practice based on things that actually are not fully evidence, but actually we just quite like the sound of it, or, you know, we got a bit excited by one paper on it, or that sort of thing. We have to be a little bit careful. But I think that's where, there are people who are doing that, but going back to our guidelines, going back to our care guidelines, is really important, because again, somebody would have done the work for you. Yeah. So for example, there's I mentioned Duchenne muscular dystrophy earlier. So they're just publishing adult Duchenne care guidance. So, and that group of people who are experts in the condition have looked at the research, looked at expert opinion, will have pulled that together. There's a new one out for Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease in children with Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease that came out for some colleagues I know in Sydney in Australia. And that's a great paper that's come out. So also to make use of those, and also things like Cochrane, again, go to the Cochrane Library, that's all open access. Just see if what people have done, if there's a particular intervention that you're not sure about. So other people will have done the work, but we still need to keep our critical head on. Yeah. And that's why doing journal clubs is great, because it keeps those skills alive and 100%. Lets you really, you know, thrash out a topic area. But we've got to be realistic as well. But making use of where people have done some of that thinking and that work for us, and then they present it back to us, and then you can make decisions is really key.
Absolutely. I think so. Even, you know, things like podcasts and videos and things like educational things, people can consume media in different ways and consume information. You take, you know, even I'd say, wrapping up now, as you listen, if whoever listens to this podcast, you know, for example, you don't have to take just our words for it particularly, you can use this as a stepping point and say, okay, this sounds interesting. Now let me go and just quickly check, just to make sure that what they've said is very accurate, because anybody can have a podcast and, you know, but I particularly bring people who I believe know what they, you know very well in the area. But yeah, use this platform as a stepping stone and then going on to do it all. Because someone like, you know, yourself, you've done a lot of this research and disseminated this information in many ways. And I'm sure what you said today is only the tip of the iceberg in the terms of the research and the reviews and the journals you've actually reviewed and been able to study. We can only go through so much, but I think it's absolutely important that we keep up to what to date in the terms of practice, mm-hmm. and make sure we're doing our own research, such as I always advocate for at the least, but listening to still the professionals who know a bit more than you and who've done that work for you, who are a bit less clinical, more clinical and more research oriented, because I'm not in research at all. So all this information for me is very interesting, and some of it, a good amount of it, is something I was not aware of, although I am treating patients particularly with some of these diseases. I was not aware of all of these things, so it's very interesting. Now I can go back and I see a patient next time with this, I have an understanding, a bit wider understanding of what's actually happened. So for that, I thank you very much, doctor, for your time, taking quite a bit of your time already. That's what happens when you come on the Rook Cell podcast, to be honest. We start talking, and I said it. Remember, I reminded you, I told you, when you start talking about one thing, we just keep going because it just keeps snowballing.
Oh, I like that. We freewheel it. I like that.
That is absolutely it. But I will have my last words, and I'll leave you, if you want to leave the audience with anything, no matter how short it is, I'll leave that to you, and then we'll call it a day there.
I think what I would say, if somebody with something really unusual, nerve or muscle condition, comes into your practice, you can go and have a look, and you know the information is there. Just be a bit judicious about what you're looking at. Look for care guidance, look for the reviews, as I was saying. But at the end of the day, most of the time, we all have the skills to be able to treat these people with what the presenting impairments are. So even if you've never seen somebody with, you know, myotonic dystrophy before, you will have treated people with balance problems, yeah, or calf weakness or that sort of thing before. So it's not forgetting the tools we have in our toolbox to apply to certain impairments and presentations. It's always reassuring to know that, you know, that we're more about the condition, and you're not going to do any harm particularly or anything like that. And certainly with, you know, with muscle diseases, I wouldn't want to be putting really large loads on muscles that are very weak, but you can exercise. But if you just use common sense and use some of the exercise prescriptions that you will for people with other comorbidities. So it's not rocket science, actually, when it comes to what we actually do. It's just, I think, we're always a bit more reassured when we know what we're dealing with.
Absolutely. Much appreciated, Keita. And thank you very much. We will see you on another episode at some point, most definitely, talking about another specific topic. Take care.
It'll be my pleasure. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast episode, but also make sure to subscribe to the Brooks Health Podcast on YouTube, as well as the podcast, so you don't miss another episode. But also follow us on social media at Rooks Health. Till the next video on the Rooks Health Podcast.